Well, good morning, everybody. Well, I'm sure we can do a little bit better than that. Good morning. Good morning, everybody. Well, you've survived an entire week and thrived on an entire week of knowledge gathering. So I bow to all the knowledge you've accumulated inside your heads. So let's give us all a round of applause. Great. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Thank you for coming to this session. Today, we are going to be talking about business-to-business collaboration. My name is Sarath Subramaniam, and I have a long history with business-to-business collaboration. Before I joined the Azure Active Directory team about 6 weeks ago, I used to be owning collaboration, authentication, and policy for SharePoint and OneDrive, and I did that for 4 years. I wrote the first spec on external collab back when there was no support in the platform, and that was about 5 years ago. And since then, have been working very closely with the AAD team to try to get the platform to support the application in the way that our customers could be successful. And then I thought this was a great opportunity to finally jump into the platform itself and build a platform that I would want to use. We are going to be, so if you have any questions about collaboration, the dark history of external collaboration, any juicy tidbits, I want to give you all of that today. Today, I'd like you to leave with an appreciation for what Azure Active Directory business collaboration is all about. Can I see a show of hands? How many of you have worked with AAD B2B Collab before? Or have written applications for it, or use a CSV file, or know about it. Okay, so that's for the folks watching on video. That's about 40% of the audience. How many of you are new to the space and are curious about what AAD business-to-business collaboration is all about? Great, so that's the majority of the audience. So welcome to all of you. I want you to walk out of here with a very good understanding of B2B Collab. What are the capabilities that we have currently introduced in the platform? Where are we going? What are the capabilities that are upcoming? And a lot of you who might have been to the B2C session yesterday, how many of you went to the B2C session yesterday? Great. A lot of you might have a question about what is the difference between B2B collaboration and B2C collaboration? Am I right? So I want you to walk out of this room with a very clear understanding of what the differences are. We've got a lot of in-depth material here and a lot of demos, so I'd appreciate it if you save the questions till the end. There will be plenty of time for questions later on. So with that, let's get started. I think you've all seen this statistic many, many times. Right? How many of you have seen the statistic in the AAD sessions? Great. So this is a very interesting, a very key statistic that is governing a lot of the design that we are doing in Azure Active Directory. And that's why we are constantly talking about this one. In particular for this session, it is the 80% number that's super, super important. This number says that 80% of the users in your organizations, or if you're an IT admin in the organizations that you're governing, and if you're an app developer, your customers, your end users who are going to be using the app, have this mentality where they are going to get their work done. They're going to get their work done with the tools that you provide or with other tools that work better for them. So can I see a show of hands on the number of people in this audience who believe that they can completely control the tools that are used in your enterprise? How many of you believe that you can completely control that? Absolutely nobody. Okay, so that tells us a lot. These users are trying to get their work done and are going to navigate to the path of least resistance that allows them to work with organizations around the world. You've probably seen that the harder it is to comply with the policies that are established within the application, the more it is that users will navigate to other applications. So what is the solution? The solution is to offer a set of tools and experiences where the path of least resistance which is the easiest thing to do, is also the right thing to do. If the easiest thing to do is the right thing to do, then we expect that this number will be more close to the number that you'd like to see. Most of you would probably like to see zero here, but it'll be closer to where you want to go. And that is the role that Azure Active Directory wants to play. Azure Active Directory wants to be the connecting fabric that brings these disparate systems around the world together without establishing, without creating additional friction in the path of the user. This is the reality of the world today. Users do want to use on-premises application together with different platforms, different mobile experiences, different devices, together with different Microsoft SaaS applications, custom applications, or third-party SaaS applications. This is the reality of the world. All the work gets done in this way. And they want to work with their collaborators within the company. They want to work with customers, and they also want to work with partners. This is the reality of the system as it is. And Azure Active Directory wants to be the fabric that makes it possible for you to connect all of these systems in a way that is compliant and also easy to use. That's the role that AAD is playing, and that's the core design principle based on which a lot of this work is happening. And why Azure Active Directory? Why not some other product? We believe that Azure Active Directory, which has a long history with a lot of enterprises, decades-long history, and a lot of trust that is developed within the enterprise, and is actually adopted by most large organizations around the world, and also increasingly smaller organizations around the world. We want to be able to offer this set of capabilities so that you as IT admins and you as app developers have one connection to make, and all of these different apps can come together and allow your customers, your partners, your end users to be able to work with each other seamlessly across boundaries. The entire week has been about talking about four pillars of Azure Active Directory. The first pillar being the ability to connect all apps with one identity, with single sign-on, that works seamlessly across any type of application, starting with Microsoft to Google to Facebook, any application that can be connected together. The ability to manage all of these identities and access at scale, and cloud power protection. You have seen all of that this week. This talk is about enabling business without borders, enabling users in your organization to be able to work with each other or other organizations around the world, or even a distributed organization in a seamless and easy to and secure manner. When we talk to customers in particular, business-to-business collaboration is coming out to be among the most important needs of a modern enterprise. Like, how many of you believe that business-to-business collaboration is critical for your enterprise or for customers or your partners that you're working with? So that is pretty representative. We live in a world where the larger the organization, the more it needs to work with other organizations to have that kind of impact, to have that kind of flexibility and velocity in developing products. And even small organizations try to scale out by working with other organizations that can add to their value. So regardless of the size of the organization, regardless of the industry in which the organization is working, regardless of its business scenarios, every organization wants to be able to work with other organizations. But today, the reality is that there is a plethora of services out there, plethora of devices out there, plethora of configurations out there that makes this super difficult for somebody to understand how to put these scenarios together. As a result, one of the most important competitors of any secure collaboration product today remains email. So when you can't get a product to work, users just attach that file in email and send it to somebody, or use a SaaS application that they have a trial subscription for, put their files in there and share out, or move their important business scenarios, important CRM or other scenarios to applications that that others can use that work seamlessly across different types of identities. What Azure AD wants to do is to create a set of solutions that works across all of these applications, all of these platforms, and all of these different user types in a way that this does not have to happen. We are going to concentrate today on a lot of how that's possible. So let's take a look at a simple scenario in which a user in one organization can collaborate with somebody entirely outside the company. So the scenario here is I work in the Woodgrove Corporation, and I want to be able to collaborate and add users to my organization without managing their identity, without managing their creds or passwords, and I want them to have access to important applications or, sorry, let me zoom in. Can you guys see this better? Great. Important applications inside my enterprise. And these are important corporate applications. Therefore, I take my security seriously. How is it possible for me to be able to securely share with somebody that does not belong to my organization? So let's take a look. So here I am signed in into Woodgrove, and this is portal.azure.com. By the way, all of these demos that I'm showing today, this is not a special tenancy. This is if you have an AAD premium tenancy, an AAD tenancy, this should be available to you already. The feature set that I'm going to talk about today is currently in public preview, which means that we have opened up for feedback and reports of experiences from our customers so that we can respond to them and then fix them over the next couple of months. So let's take a look here. I'm going to be adding to my set of users let us say I wanted to work with Sam, and Sam's address is Sam is running a small business. He works for a design company that does packaging for the products that Woodgrove ships. And he does not have any presence in Azure Active Directory. He may not even know what AAD is. All he does is he uses his Gmail address for business. And that's how we have always collaborated over email. But now I realize that he needs deeper access to the resources in my organization. So I'm going to add him to AAD. So now, I can go in and configure a particular profile for him. So add his name, Sam, designer. His job title is consultant. His department is packaging. Okay. And that's it. This is it. This is all I have to do to include Sam inside my organization. Now let's see what happens when I go and look to see if he's there. There he is. Here's Sam's profile. His name, his email address, which I can, there are some properties in here that I can edit, like his name, his last name, and I can upload a photograph. Let's see here. Let's find something. Let's say this. And then you see that his user entity has been created with an object ID, just like you'd expect. Now, here's something interesting. It looks like that file is too big to upload. So, but with a smaller file, you could be able to upload a profile picture for Sam. The interesting thing here is the user type object, the user type property. The user type property says that Sam is a guest. Now, the guest user type means that there is a particular relationship that it implies. There are certain set of policies that would apply to guests by default, and we'll take a look at what those policies are. But the idea here is that if an organization does not want their CEO's five-year plans to be exposed to everybody in the directory, which is the state today, then this property, user type property, prevents that from happening. It allows the system to know that this is a special relationship, and I should treat it not on par with my internal users, and I should treat it with the right appropriate policy application. And that applies regardless of the group or the context in which the user is present, because it is carried forward along with the user. And then there's the source. The source says this is an invited user. Somebody invited Sam at this address to the organization. So I am, as soon as I'm adding, I added Sam, I can now go and update certain profile properties. I can add some alternate contact information, et cetera. Essentially, I can treat him almost as if Sam belongs to the organization, except that the system by default adds certain properties to the user that allows us to keep the security intact. But as far as the user is concerned, I didn't have to do anything special to make any of this happen. Now, let me show another user so we can compare what those user properties, another invited user, so that we can compare what those user properties look like. Here is a user, and you see here that this user has a profile picture because whoever invited him was able to go and update that property. This user is, again, from a different company. This is not a Woodgrove email account. This is a Microsoft.com email address. And then going down, you can see that the same properties apply, object ID, user type is equal to guest, and the source is external Azure Active Directory. So the idea here is that when this user, an external user from who does not belong to your enterprise, whether he belongs to another Azure Active Directory instance or has a consumer domain email address, can be added in the same exact way and can be treated as users of the same exact type. And therefore, how the user signed in is not relevant anymore. There are other interesting things about the user that the system has now based on which policy can be applied. Now, let's see what Sam's experience is when he there you go. So when Sam was added to Azure Active Directory, an out-of-the-box email with an invitation, with a particular URL in there, goes to him that Sam can click on. And the first thing Sam sees is this message. So let me talk a little bit about this message. The first thing is, Sam here does not have an opportunity to use a different email account than the one that was invited. This is for security reasons. This is to make sure that if you were invited and you forwarded your invitation to somebody else, then without the appropriate approval, that somebody else cannot claim that invitation. And this happens seamlessly without Sam having to do anything about it. So security that relies on an end user to act in a particular way doesn't quite work. And this is out-of-the-box security. The second thing you'd see here is that to access Woodgrove, Sam can use that email address, but we are going to convert it in the back end to a Microsoft account. But that is the current state, and in the future, we have plans of supporting social IDs natively, where a Microsoft account is not needed anymore. Now, Sam can click Next here and enter his MSA password. Now, imagine that Sam actually did not have an MSA associated with his Google email ID yet, Google account yet, then Sam could click on Create an Account. In this case, this won't work, but this is illustrative of a very, very simple sign-up process. So in this case, Sam can click on Create an Account, choose a password, and get into the system. Sam does not have to be aware of the fact that this is an MSA backing the email address. But since Sam already has an MSA, we are going to go back and sign in. That spurious page is going to go away very soon. What we need there is to pass the right home realm so that that page can be skipped. And that's work currently happening back in Redmond. Now, all Sam did was click on the email invitation, signed in, and got access. Now, let's go back and see what the admin's view of the world is now. So I can come back here and search for Sam. And you see that his property has now been updated from source being invited user, source has been now updated to Microsoft account. That's pretty much all that happened in the back end. Sam came and accepted the invitation and now is a regular, fully fledged user in the directory. If I so wanted, I could go to overview, or another admin who saw this can go to overview and delete the user, and we'll take a look at some of the other properties of the user that that the admin would be able to see. So we saw that Sam having a Gmail address or Sarath who had a Microsoft.com address were both added very easily into the Azure Active Directory as guest users. How did this happen? What is the tech that makes it happen? Let's take a quick look at that. This here is the Woodgrove tenancy. And a user from the Woodgrove tenancy sends an invitation, let us say, to somebody at a Microsoft.com email address. As this invitation flows out, it looks like this. It looks like a canned email address out of the box, and we'll talk about how to customize it later on, that has a particular link that allows the user to get fully provisioned inside the directory. But what happens as soon as the email flies out is that we create a representation of that user in the directory. That representation looks like this. The user's name, which we don't know yet, all we know is the user's email address. The user's name gets represented as sasubram@microsoft.com. The user's UPN, note that the user's UPN is in the woodgroveonline.com domain, but it is a representation of the fact that sasubram@microsoft.com was invited. Now, this UPN should be completely transparent to any app that you write. And as admins, none of this should be used to make a decision on whether the user is external, truly a guest user or not. There is a property that we saw that said user type equal to guest. That's the one that represents what the relationship is of the user to the organization. So that UPN exists because some apps use it, but ignore it for now. There is a PUID or an object ID that is self-generated, auto-generated in the Active Directory. This is the property that is used for permissioning, ACLing, and so on. For example, SharePoint would use this property to grant access to certain resources. And this is a self-generated property. And then we update the email address. This is all we know about the user. Now it's represented in the directory. What is the advantage of already adding this user in the directory? There are several advantages. One of them is that now this user can get synced in to all the workload directories. And when it gets synced in, let's say, to a SharePoint directory, then when you pull up the SharePoint people picker and try to invite a user or add a user, ACL them, then Sarath shows up in the people picker. This allows you to create workflows around adding a user to your organization just as if they were a new employee. When a new hire comes into the organization, there is a certain workflow that you have, which is to add the user here, then grant them access to this particular site collection, add them to a particular group that belongs to their team, and assign them a particular workflow. Now everything is ready, and when the user comes back in, it all just comes to life. We want to enable the same sort of experiences for collaborators as well. And for that reason, this is super useful. The second reason this is useful is, as an admin, you can now get notified that a new guest user was added. Maybe you want to take a look. Maybe you want to audit whether that user should really be in there. You can respond to security incidents before they have a chance to happen. So you're able to look at what is happening in the directory and have complete control over it. You can delete the user before he becomes a real user. For all of these reasons now, there is a representation in the directory that says this user is going to come and is going to become an active collaborator in this organization. Now, inside the Microsoft SDS, Sarath has some other details. So he has a PUID that comes with his auth token. He has his name and other profile information. And now let's say that Sarath clicks on that invitation and signs in. The first thing that happens is he communicates this information through that auth token to the Woodgrove SDS. Now we have all the information of the collaborator. Also communicates, along with the having clicked it, posts back an invitation ID that allows us to link the user that we have with this token. And once we are able to link both of them, we are able to now activate that user across the organization. Now the user is actually activated to sign in and collaborate. So let's take a look at this flow one more time. An inviter invites an email address. That's all we know right now. That email goes out. As that email goes out, a representation of that user is created in the directory, which imprints everything that we know currently. Everything that we know currently. And then that gets synced into all these directories that are downstream so that they can do their appropriate things. Then the user is visible to the people picker and admin experiences. Then the user signs in. Once the user signs in, we update all the user entity properties that we know with the data that comes in the auth token. So now, the user entity that exists in Woodgrove is a fully fledged user entity with something called the AllSec ID. We talked about the user type property. That is something that is super useful to you. When you write a script, a user type property is very handy to apply the right kind of policies. The thing that you don't quite need to care about, there are two things. One is the UPN, and the other is the AllSec ID. But if you'd like to know, the AllSec ID is the thing that points us to the identity system that the user is homed in. So it allows us to connect two entities that are disparate across different directories and still use them for ACLing, but connect the identity systems in a way that we know that it belongs somewhere else. So you could imagine a case where if you hired a contractor and had them sign in with a Google email address, and then they are coming in and they're doing work in your organization as a guest user, they do a great job. Now you want to hire them, you want to make them an offer for the exact same work that they were doing for you. All you have to do is snip out the AllSec ID, theoretically, change the user type to member, and the user is now a fully fledged user of your organization if you assign them an email address. And now they are completely within your system, they are a member of your organization, and don't lose access to anything they had before. So that is the power of this design. Now, we spoke about inviting a Gmail email address, and we also saw how an existing AAD account can come in and claim an invitation. So then the question is, what remains? What are the other email addresses that remain? What about an email address that is an organizational email address that does not exist in AAD at all? This is a completely on-prem organization, and you have an email address that is on-prem, your Exchange mailbox is on-prem, but you have been invited to collaborate in Office 365 or in some SaaS application that is supported by AAD. How does that work? Let's take a look. So for this, for this demo, and this is a complete, you can try it out on your own, but what you need is a domain that you own and an email address associated with that domain that works. And if you have that, you can try inviting it, and it doesn't need to have anything else. You can try inviting it and see what the flows look like. In this case, this is the host organization, MS Online Setup, that invited this user from a partner organization. This is an on-prem organization. Right now, the inviter has no idea that it's an on-prem organization. The user has clicked on the invitation, has landed on this page. He clicks next. All Arvind has to do is choose a password. Tells us this is optional. If he wants to put in a name, Arvind can put in his name and click next. We verify that Arvind indeed owns the email address that was invited, because we don't want somebody else to pretend to be a member of that organization. So email verification happens. Once that happens, Arvind gets access to the portal. So a user who has no footprint in AAD at all was easily onboarded and has the same type of capabilities that you saw a couple of screens back that is available to both the host organization and the user. How does this work? So the host tenancy in this case is MS Online Setup on the left. What happens when Arvind comes and clicks on next is that we create a dynamic tenancy on the right. We just spin up a free AAD tenancy. We assign a particular domain to it. It's on Microsoft.com domain. This is not the B2B test 074.com domain, but an on Microsoft.com domain. And then we add a user to that tenancy with Arvind's information. And then that user is then, now this becomes similar to the Microsoft.com invitation flow that you saw earlier, where that user is now granted access to resources in your host organization. And right now, therefore, this flow has created a free tenancy on the side with certain users. If another user from the same organization comes back in, he would get added to the same tenancy. So now that raises a few questions. The first is, right, so we'll go through these questions, and if you still have that question, we can talk about it later. The first is, can Arvind choose to decide not to create that account? Can he choose to sort of skip out of that flow? Yes, he can. What happens then is, we don't want to create a spurious MSA identity that's essentially actually belongs to an organization that might come to AAD later. So we stop the invitation flow right there. The second is, when the tenant is taken over, Arvind can choose to take over this tenant himself. When he takes that over, all he has to do is prove that he owns that domain. And if he proves that he owns that domain, then that becomes a proper AAD tenancy of which Arvind can become the administrator. And all the users in that tenancy now have two choices. One is, either that user can stay as is, which means that there is a cloud password that they use to access that tenancy, or if the organization is federated with an ADFS instance on-prem and they want to use their on-prem domain credentials, then they can connect that organization to their on-prem ADFS instance with AAD Connect. And what that does is then converts these users to federated users. And the next time some user who's in this organization signs in, he's told, hey, your password here, this tenant has been taken over, and click here to sign in with your domain credentials. And so it's a smooth takeover process that happens from there. An organization can choose to keep their on-prem and their cloud deployment separate or join them to have a more secure topology. Does that answer your question? Great. Okay, so now, let's take a look at what happens. This user has been invited and has been added to Azure Active Directory. What happens next? So let's go back here to the Azure portal. Let us say that I have an application here that I want to give access to one of these users. For the purposes of this demo, I'm going to choose go to the applications menu, and I'm going to click on all applications, and there's a set of applications that is associated with this organization. I'm going to choose Salesforce. Let's go to the users and groups. These are the users that have access to this Salesforce application. I added the Microsoft.com guy so that he can work on the Salesforce application together with me. So I'm going to add I have to scroll on the right. I'm going to add Sarath, the Microsoft.com user. Note that this user does not belong to the Woodgrove organization. I select Sarath. And I choose the role that I want Sarath to play in the Salesforce application. Let's say standard user. And then assign. Wow, that's a long way over there. Okay. So here, Sarath has been added to the Salesforce application as a standard user. That's all I needed to do. This is a guest user, but nothing in the system tells me that this operation will not work. It doesn't tell me that there isn't any friction. So this just works. Nothing special needs to happen here. So now that Sarath has been added, how does he access? Let's sign into the My Apps portal. I'm on a Microsoft.com domain join machine, and I'm dropped directly without any friction to the My Apps portal. And then I click on the Salesforce application, and there it is. There was no extra prompt, no extra connections that I need to make. All I did was point and click, and I got in. Going back to the admin experience, after having added Sarath, this admin is taking a look at all the users that have have come into the system that are external to the organization, and he's trying to see if there is any information about them, as part of his routine checkup, if there's anything suspect going on. So he searches for Sarath, and he sees a bunch of users that have been added to the directory, including a guy from a gmail.com account. So he's curious. He clicks on this. And he sees that 3 sign-ins have happened, and the latest one just 2 days ago. So he clicks on the sign-in events and looks at this. Well, looks like that gmail.com user accessed the access panel and tried to access Salesforce once and failed. The first time he failed, and the second time he succeeded. This is suspect. He didn't expect this to happen. So what he decides to do is enable multi-factor auth on the Salesforce application. So I go to manage.windowsazure.com. He wants to make sure that nothing suspect is happening here. He wants to enable multi-factor auth on all of these authentications to the Salesforce application till such time that he can investigate and figure out what's happening. So he goes down, sees the Salesforce application here, goes to configure, and says, I want to enable multi-factor auth. All right, so here, Let's go and sign out of the Salesforce account so that the settings can take effect. Great. So now let's try this as Sarath at Microsoft.com. Okay. So now I'm having to sign in one more time. The system detected that there was a new policy in force and therefore did not allow the sign-in to complete and wants me to now step up authentication. So I'm going to sign in with my password here. And now I'm going to get a notification for signing into the same application that I signed in seamlessly on my Azure Authenticator app. And there it is. So multi-factor auth for an application, a SaaS application, in my host organization, that is applied to an external collaborator. And it's just as easy as clicking on a button. Now, what are the other things that this user can do? Okay, so he also sees the Sarath at live.com guy and wants to figure out how he got into the system in the first place. He can go to the audit log, and here's a complete history of who invited whom, when, what apps were assigned to him, when was his license changed. Everything is captured in AAD. So the idea here is that regardless of how the user signs in, whether they are external to the organization or internal to the organization, the same set of admin capabilities automatically accrue to this external collaborator as well. Do you guys like that? No? Great. All right. So let's go back to the rest of the... So what we saw here was the ability to apply multi-factor auth to an external identity, the ability to see sign-in reports, audits, and also the sign-in anomaly reports whenever they apply, just like you saw in the Azure Identity Protection talks. The same sort of capabilities apply here as well. So 3 key things that we just saw was you can invite any email address on the planet to collaborate with you. You can have the same set of auditing, reporting, and controls that internal users have in your organization that secure your enterprise. And you can also have multi-factor auth that protects authentication for external collaborators. Let's see what's next. The first question is, so I did all of this. There is a particular user that I invited, and all of these controls are in place. What is it for? What is BDP really for? So when an organization works together with another organization for whatever reason, when two organizations have a relationship together and you are working with a particular user within that organization, there are certain rules that govern that behavior, that certain rules that govern that relationship. They are that there is a legal contract between the two of your companies. Even if a particular user, a Gmail user or a Microsoft.com user is added to the organization, he's not added as that Gmail user, he is added as a representative of the organization to which he belongs, the organization that is giving him a paycheck. Which means that if that relationship goes away, you want your relationship with that person to also go away automatically. This is the characteristic of business-to-business collaboration. And that is what you saw just now, the ability to generate this partner relationship, which is tightly governed by policy. Who is it for? Every user who comes in through the B2B flow is a representative of another organization. He is standing in for Microsoft. He's standing in for his design company. He's not acting on his own accord. And that is an important part of what B2B is about. The second is the management, and the policy, and the controls that govern that behavior. There are things like access reviews. Every time a user comes in, maybe every few months, you want to review whether that user should continue to have access or not. That is an important part of this feature. For example, you also want to have things like allow lists or deny lists, which govern what kind of organizations can you work with and what kind of organization do you not want to work with. And that should accrue to SharePoint and other SaaS applications that are also integrated with Azure Active Directory. And finally, these users are collaborators, right? You need to be able to find them in the people picker, assign them tasks, assign them workflows. If a user in one particular company comes in, he probably should be able to discover other users in his company who are in the same context. Perhaps discover employees who are working in the same context so that projects can happen together. So that's what B2B collaboration is about. Now, how come we saw that in an organization, I showed you adding one user, right? How does that relate to the scope of what B2B is about? Ideally, when two organizations come together, you want to be able to say some things like, I am working with a product manager or a project manager in this other company. Here's the project on which both of us need to collaborate. And so I just add the project manager or a product manager group into my organization, and my partner can manage the membership of that other partner group. That's the direction in which you're headed. But a lot of our customers have been asking for the ability to invite a single user at a time because a lot of projects can be modeled as single users working together across these boundaries, regardless of the identity that they use. So we want to support both of these patterns. We are focusing currently on the user pattern, and we are going to be shifting to also be supporting the group pattern. Now, as these two patterns are out here, there is a third pattern that a lot of you ask us for, which is the ability of two entire organizations to work together. So instead of having one user to be picked at a time or a group to be picked at a time, you want two organizations to collaborate. And this is the case of, a multi-geo organization, which has multiple subsidiaries around the world, and you want to connect them together in one resource tenancy with their identities coming from across the world. How many of you have that scenario in the customer that you're representing? Great. So let me start with the good news. The good news is that we are in the process of designing back in Redmond what these relationships would look like. But I also want to add a little bit of clarity when we talk about that scenario. Typically, a lot of our customers think of modeling this as a B2B type relationship, a business-to-business relationship. But there is a little flaw in that model. And the flaw is that the nature of a B2B relationship is that of two disparate, separate legal entities that come together. Which means that the user that you add from this other organization is essentially, by default, a limited access user. In a lot of your complex geo-distributed organization cases, you probably want to treat these other users as members, as full-time employees. So when a CEO sends out a 5-year plan, you want all of these different people in different organizations to get it. Am I right? If that is true, then that is not quite B2B. It might use the same tech stack. It could be that it's modeled the same way as we are modeling now, but there are sudden differences in the policies that are governing that relationship. And those are the things that we are trying to design out right now back in Redmond. So this B2B set of capabilities is available for you. If you're happy with the fact that these extra other users from these organizations are going to be added as limited access users in the directory, and they have limitations. There are 50 things that a member can do, let's say, and a guest user can really, by default, only do 10 of them. There are policies that allow you to grant the guest user more access, but there is a certain restriction. If you have questions about this, find me after the talk and we can talk more. So as we do this, as we do the user-to-user collaboration, the group collaboration, what's next? And as we talk to a lot of our customers, one of the most important things that jumps out in a vast majority of the cases is the ability to automate some of these. It's the ability to write applications, scripts, and maybe do bulk invites. Can I see a show of hands? How many of you think that this is really, really crucial to your plans? Great. So I have great news for you. I want to announce today that we have just gone into public preview of a sharing API, and I'm going to demo to you today. You can go and find it, and somebody applauded. I'll take applause for the engineers back home. Thank you. So it's in public preview. Anybody can. There's no special sign-up required. You can go try it out in your own tenancy. Let's see how that works. So here I am in this tenancy. All I have to do is say graph.microsoft.io. Now, note that this is the Graph API, and you've seen a lot of the demos here. The Graph Explorer is just a nifty tool that I'm using for demonstrating, but this is essentially an API that you can build and compile against. Right, so let me sign in with my work credentials. There it is. And to show that this is real, here's me. Here's who I am. And this is Tamil, for those who are wondering. The admin who set this up loves the South Indian Tamil language. So now let's look at what the invitation manager looks like. The method in the Graph API, this is in beta because it's in public review. And once it comes into general availability, it'll go to V2. But right now it's in beta. This is the method that we are going to use today. And here I have a JSON payload just waiting to be used. So once I type that in, let's walk through it and see what the different elements of it are. Number one, so from the API perspective, we want this to be the tool that you use for any heavy customization. And so there are lots of things here that can be customized. The first thing you see here is, what is the invited user display name? Some display name. What is the invited user address? You saw us use both of these in the UX. Then there's this a property, send invitation message, true. Now, when send invitation message is true, this would generate a pre-canned invitation message that just goes out, and that looks like the email that I showed you, which is just a basic email. All that's super useful there is the notification that it comes from a particular organization, and there's an invitation URL. But you might want to customize that email. You might want to brand it with your company branding. And that would mean that you can just take you can convert the send invitation message to false, and that take the URL that comes back in response, and then apply it to your workflow. You can also CC any recipients who you want to keep updated of the fact that this user is being invited. There is a particular message body that you can put here, and then you can also customize the invite redirect URL. The things that you could not customize in the UX flow, you can customize all of them here. So let's see what happens when I hit submit. Great. So there it is. Do you guys like this? The invite redeem URL, which is the redemption URL, which is also going to go out in the email. And it tells me that the invited user ID, the object ID in the directory is such. So you can imagine how you can snap on any sort of workflow where a new object ID is created. You could notify an admin. You could do any of those things with this API. Let's see what actually happens when I run this. So I was here, signed in as. There it is. So this one is the invitation. I click on this, and the same sort of experience. I'm already signed in with my MSA, so there it is. I'm now dropped on the access panel. So that invitation URL that I just generated, it works in the following way. Now, what if I did not want to generate an invitation URL? What if I just wanted to get, what if I did not want to generate the notification mail, but just wanted to get the invitation URL back? Let's take a look. So I'm going to put in a different, I'm going to call this guest admin, and I'm going to invite a different email address. See if I got this right. And I'm going to convert this to false, and I'm going to nullify this. All the optional parameters don't even need to occur in the JSON payload. I just put them in there so you can see the what the payload in it looks like in its entirety. And there it is. I have sent an invitation out, and I've gotten the invite redeem URL back. Let me put this in the browser here. Let's see if it works. There it is. I can sign in now with the admin account. Not that one. This one. I've enabled MFA in the other tenancy, so I'm going to get a text message, hopefully get it. 742603. Great. So you saw that I was able to get an invitation URL. I was able to, and perfect. Actually, there it is, because that's the home tenancy that shows up by default. This is the tenancy that I was invited to. I'm able to automatically apply the policies for the other organization, whether it be MFA or not. I'm able to invite an MSA or a Gmail email address, and an organizational email address using this highly customizable invitation API. What's next in this API is that we are going to, as it stands today, you need to run this application in the context of the user. So when a user is signed in, he can run the application, and then the invitations are, all the actions are performed as the signed in user. We are working on enabling an app-only context. So you can imagine where you can write a timer job or some sort of an application that runs autonomously, just watches to see if there are changes in the directory and does the appropriate thing with the invitation manager, and then ties into other organization workflows. All of them can look inside the directory and see what is happening and the source of truth is right there. So you can imagine how all of these powerful applications that can come to life with the invitation URL. Do you guys like that? So as we are on that topic, we have somebody, Peter, would you stand up please for a second? So Peter Carson has a set of applications that he's writing to customize the onboarding and the approval process as new guest users are added. If you're interested in that thing, or if your customers or partners have an interest in that scenario, find him after the talk, and he can talk to you more about how he did it and how this invitation API might change. Thank you, Peter. Great. So what is this useful for? How are there customers that are using it? So we are working with a number of external parties as well as internal parties, and we'll talk about some stories here. Kodak Aleris has 3,000-plus partners that it works with and are using the B2B Invitation Manager and the platform as it exists, and they have just started using the Invitation API to automate some of their workflows. And as we are doing a lot of this work inside the Azure Active Directory, one of the key benefits of doing that is that it now automatically applies to all the Microsoft applications out of the box. All of the Office 365 applications can now reason about the guest user that was created through any of these flows. You might have seen the guests in groups experiences that is powered by the guest users being inside the Active Directory. You might have also seen the sharing and B2B presentations from SharePoint. And that is powered by the users being present in AAD. As we have done that work, as I did that work as part of the SharePoint team for the past several years, because we were so ahead off the curve in terms of the offerings that were made in the market, a lot of important customer requirements came up that the SharePoint team had to take, which means that now we are working with them to enhance the API and the feature set inside Azure Active Directory to come up and support the scenarios that SharePoint needs. Once we are done, all of Office 365 will be powered by the same set of APIs and the same set of platform features that you just saw here that are available to customers. And so that is a great unifying factor that pulls in all of these disparate SaaS applications on-prem and devices together in a way that you don't have to do anything special when you inject a new SaaS application into the equation. Do you guys like that? Once you onboard an AAD guest invitation manager, you can see how this will open up the entire Microsoft suite, services suite for you, and connect it with the application that you're writing. So what's coming in the future? One of the things that let me take a step back and show the equivalent experience that exists today so that this would make a little bit more sense. Let's go here to the admin view. And let me go to Azure Active Directory, where the user settings are, and show you this part of the settings here. There are three very simple controls that exist today. Those controls are, first, one of the assumptions that we are making is if you're an administrator of the directory, then you should be able to invite guest users regardless of what the policy says. Now, we believe that a policy setting inside the directory should actually accrue to all users, and we'll talk about how we are changing that in the future. The next is a setting that allows external collaborators in your organization to be able to invite other external collaborators. And finally, whether you want to restrict guest access in the directory or not. Now, this is the case where when a guest user is added to the directory, by default, there are certain things that he just can't do. For example, you don't want your collaborator to enumerate all the full-time employees in your organization and go and look at the CEO's cell phone number and then reach out to them for a marketing thing. You don't want that to happen. So you don't want that. There are certain restrictions out of the box that apply. However, there are organizations that have the need for having this full-fledged integration with their partners. Those organizations can choose to remove these restrictions and even make these guest users admins of their directory so that they can invite others. And so they can do, as cloud service providers, they can do invite on behalf of and managing on behalf of A lot of organizations just outsource those responsibilities to another organization. We want to make that possible as well. But by default, this setting is off. The enhancements that we are making here that you see in this UI, which is currently being worked on back in Redmond, is that this entire thing is role-based. If you see, you can always say guest user permissions are limited or not, but at the same time, you can have multiple roles in the directory that govern the guest user behavior. That's the direction in which we are going. Does this make sense? Does this resonate? You can manage what a guest user can do based on the role that they're occupying, and there's nothing special about the user type anymore. And we want the user type to be something that just represents the relationship and nothing else in terms of policy. Great. The next thing that is currently in planning, this has been a super high request from a lot of our customers, is the ability to figure out how frequently to govern whether a guest user should continue to have access to resources in the directory or not. So every once in a while, the ability to go and review whether this guest user should have access to it or not, and then cleaning it up. We are going to start this off by it being a manual evaluation of a particular group to which a guest user has been added. But in the future, we'll also automate this. Some other upcoming capabilities. So the green ones are the ones that we saw. The ability to invite any account on the planet, invitation API to allow automation of the invitation and management processes, bringing the external users auditing capabilities on par with internal users, all of those things we saw. We're also going to work on making the identity and access management experience for guest users identical to that of internal users. So we are going to bring it on par with how you manage internal users. So a number of things there are going to happen, like your ability to add a guest user directly to an application, to a group, et cetera. We saw the ability to delegate who can invite to a particular role. That's the UI that I just showed you. Based on roles, you can manage who can do what. There is an issue right now that a few of you, I'd be interested to know how many in this audience have faced this issue, is that when you have a contact in the Active Directory and you are inviting a guest user, that it somehow doesn't seem to work. Do you have anybody in this audience who cares about that scenario? Two people. Okay, great. You guys, we are working on the solution. Talk to me afterwards and I can talk to you about how we are thinking about designing it. And access reviews, the ability to do to send UPNs to applications, and then completing the MFA flow, where you can rely on the partner MFA or substitute the partner MFA if they don't have one with your own. So all of those things are coming up. So let's take a slight detour here and talk about what is the difference between B2B and B2C. How many of you have this question where you're figuring out customers, do you want them to use Azure AD B2C or a B2B collaboration? A couple of you here. So let's talk about this. We spoke about B2B being something about what the relationship looks like, what are the management capabilities, et cetera. The key thing in this slide that we want to convey is these are the pivots based on which you should make the decision. Currently, if you're thinking about, hey, I want to support social ID federation, therefore, B2C is the only way I can go. Or if I want to support sort of self-service or customization, et cetera, et cetera. There are a few things that currently govern the decision that you're making. What we want to say is, forget about those things, because those technologies will come back together and unite. For example, we will support social ID federation with B2B as well. The things that you should ask yourself when you choose to go the B2B way or the B2C way is, what is the scenario that your customer is trying to address here? Is there a scenario around two businesses coming together? Is this a relationship that is based on who the user works for rather than who the user is? If the answer to that is yes, then use B2B. But if this is about reaching end users directly, if this is about your customers and selling directly to customers and giving them extra capabilities in your application, then use B2C. Next, that user is always in B2B context working on behalf of an organization. In the B2C context, the user is representing himself. So this is not about the identity that the user is using. It is about the relationship that they have with you. Manageability. In the case of B2C, you never want to kick a customer out. When you're reaching out to an end user, your Costco's, you know, and you have end users coming to your portal and printing out photos, you want them to remain your customers forever. You want to retain them. So the user manages the life cycle of their relationship by choosing to leave the application, choosing to discontinue. The organization does not want to manage it. But in the B2B case, the relationship is entirely managed by the host organization. And it's managed through through a federated partnership with the guest organization, and maybe there's legal paperwork involved, but there is there's a notion of life cycle in the B2B case. And then finally, we spoke about how partners are discoverable. You want a guest user collaborator to see other people in this company. You want them to work with full-time employees and so on and so forth. In the case of B2C, that is a strict no-no. You don't want your customers to be able to discover each other. You want them to come get value, and then you want to retain their privacy. So these are major differences between the two. Now, this is not to say that this is an either-or. You might find that your customer has requirement for both of these scenarios in various contexts. And we are working on how that will come together. Both B2B and B2C can come together. But for now, if you're choosing to go one way or the other, these are the pivots based on which you should take that decision. Let me give you an example. For the B2C customer story, a super high value scenario that we have shipped is Real Madrid and their ability to reach out to their fans through their mobile application and through their web application. So these fans are coming in, signing up for an account using any identity, and they're getting access to Real Madrid specials and resources. Whereas a B2B customer story is when Microsoft, for example, manages its partner network and do work together to help our customers. That's an example of a B2B story. So let's take a look at what Microsoft did.
As Microsoft has evolved through the years, our business-to-business systems for our partners have grown and evolved also. As partners work with us across different lines of business, OEM, cloud, volume licensing, etc., the number of tools they must use can be extensive. Some partners reported to us they used as many as 65 different sites. On top of the number of tools, there is a mix and match of identities for each user. MSA accounts, corporate IDs, Azure Active Directory IDs, a lot to keep track of. My organization, Worldwide Operations, obsesses about partners and making it easy for them to do business with Microsoft. Our goal is to continuously improve and transform the end-to-end partner experience. When we ask partners, how can we make it easier for you to do business with us, addressing this multi-site, multi-ID issue is a top pain point. And we tell partners the truth, that we are working hard on the portals of the future that will deliver both identity and portal consolidation, acknowledging that those solutions are in the future and don't address the problem today. But one day I thought, there must be something we can do now to simplify the experience. So I did some research and found that business-to-business identity as a service solutions are out there. Solutions that once configured give users one-click access to their sites without remembering usernames, passwords, and URLs. And as it turned out, Microsoft was about to launch one.
Cross-company.
I'm going to pause here just in the interest of time. Microsoft IT is a very, very key partner, and within Microsoft, we have some of the most sophisticated collaboration scenarios and some of the most sophisticated security scenarios, and also some of the most discerning and demanding customers within Microsoft. I'll give you an anecdote. When we turned on multi-factor auth within Microsoft, the first time we tried it within Microsoft, sign-in completions dropped by around 90%, which means only 10% of the users were able to complete their sign-in. And we saw that as a result of that, that the amount of data that was going on systems that were not controlled by Microsoft IT just proliferated. And that resulted in our taking a deep rethink on how security scenarios should be built in the first place in a way that data stays safe, because there's no point in creating a concrete box where it's hard to put stuff in, hard to take out stuff in, because most interesting stuff stops going there anymore. Most interesting stuff happens outside your controlled environment. This is the genesis of why we think that security will not be useful if it also does not advance usability. So a lot of what Azure Active Directory is trying to do and make available inherently as a part of the platform is the fabric that makes collaboration easy and secure by making security something that you don't have to contend with at all. That user who invited this external collaborator doesn't have to think about it. The collaborator who came in doesn't have to think about it. But all that happens that controls the and governs the security happens silently in the substrate. We want to be as invisible as possible. And that's the direction in which B2B collaboration is going. With that, I'll end here and open up for questions. Thank you. Do you want to come to a mic so others can hear you? Sorry, did they? So currently I'll let Jose here, who owns the B2C capabilities, answer the question. I believe currently not, right? Not right now. The question was, does the invitation API also work with a B2C tenant? And the answer is currently it doesn't. Currently they are two different things, and we are working on what we might do to bring them together.
Hi. Just a clarification question. On one of your slide decks, I saw perhaps for Q3 this year, something about a list of potentially trusted domains.
Yeah.
Is that correct? So does that mean on the roadmap there could be trust between tenants?
So that's a good catch. I think you saw it in the SharePoint roadmap. The list of trusted tenancies is the allow list and deny list feature, where you can say, these are the domains that I trust to collaborate, and these are the domains that I don't. And you can have either or. And the way we are doing it right now is going to be controlled at the resource end. So SharePoint's going to control it. And the future AD is also going to do this. So it's not a trust between two tenants in the way I think you're thinking about it, because I know yours is a federated organization case. It is that Contoso wants to be able to work with FabricAM, but not Wingtip Toys. And they are two completely different legal entities. So that's the kind of trust that we are talking about right now. Thanks.
One question. Want to clarify, am I correct that inviting the account from another tenant requires some action from the user, right, to accept the invitation?
Yes.
And in the old management portal, Azure portal, you have a way to add external account without these invitations, just selecting the account from another ED tenant. Is it still a way to create external accounts, or is it going to be removed? Or
it won't be removed. Actually, we are the current preview that you see mm-hmm. does not include that functionality, but we are adding it. We are including it, where you'll be able to pick users from the other organization without their needing an invitation.
Without any interaction from the user.
That's
side,
right.
Yeah. Okay, great. And this will be available in the API as well.
Yes.
Currently, it is not, right?
No, it's not. In the current preview, the API is app plus user. And in the current preview, the API needs invitations. Uh-huh. In the upcoming releases, we'll have app only, and we'll also have the ability to add from the other directory.
Any time frames on this? Yeah.
So we are working on getting feedback from these APIs. The faster we understand what the changes are, the faster we'll be able to go. But it's only determined by the feedback. We want to go as fast as possible.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
So when you have MFA enabled on a service, say Office 365 or SharePoint, what happens if the guest users don't have MFA? Are they just blocked out, or what happens?
Yeah. So the question is, when MFA is enabled, what happens when the partner does not have MFA? In the current demo that I showed you, the assumption is that the partner has an MFA. We are introducing a capability, we are designing the capability that if the partner does not have the MFA, then your organization can step in and say, I will register your phone, and I will manage the step up, and the other organization will manage your sign-in, and I'll do the extra sync. So the user will not be stuck in that case. We'll be able to authenticate, step up with you, with your organization.
When will that be available?
Also, we are working on it. We are working on it furiously.
Yeah. And can we be able to use also conditional access for the guest user?
Yes, absolutely. So the goal is to be, the question is, can we use conditional access for guest users? You saw one example of conditional access, which is MFA, that I demonstrated right now.
Yeah.
We are also working on what does it mean to have device-based conditional access for a guest user? Because some of these things are not that straightforward to answer. Do you, when you enable conditional access that is based on managed device, do you want your guest users to be blocked or allowed? Mm-hmm. Right. So those are the interesting questions that we have to address. And if we do want to block it, then we'll have to figure out how to get the guest users to enroll their device in some meaningful way, who might already have their devices enrolled by their host organization, home organization. So we are the desire is definitely we will support it. We are figuring out what the right modalities are to support it.
Okay. I have also one more question. On the demo, we have created the user B2B test, and that creates a dynamic tenant, right?
Yes.
b2btest.onmicrosoft.com.
Yes.
When the user creates another tenant and adds the domain b2btest.com to this tenant, what happens then?
Well, so if right. the pattern here is, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it exists then two times in the Azure AD.
So I think, so that's a great question. The way we are thinking about it right now is that this viral tenancy will itself be converted into having that particular domain. So you can come in and change that domain. If somebody comes and grabs that domain and creates another tenancy in AAD, then you're right, this viral tenancy will have to go away, and the users will have to move to the other tenancy.
Yes.
So there are processes that we have of and best practices that we will share so that that is less likely to happen. But when it does happen, there are other folks in Azure Active Directory who are contending with the same problem anyway in other contexts. And so we'll figure out how to do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hello. If we have Office 365 in basic Azure Directory, will we be able to use the Share API?
Yeah. So the sharing API is free, is included. And so you can invite as many users as you want. You can use the UX, et cetera. The thing that we are going to be charging for is extra capabilities like multi-factor auth, group-based management, access to more than 10 applications, et cetera. That's the current thinking. We haven't finalized it yet. When the feature gets closer to GA, that's when we'll announce our final licensing terms. But the basic functionality we are anticipating will be free.
And will we be able to access or launch that from a SharePoint workflow or a SharePoint flow?
So the any application that can authenticate and call the Graph API will be able to use it.
Okay. And what about time-based removal of users? Is that something that we'd have to pay for, or would that be part of Office 365?
The time-based users, as in a guest who's invited for 30 days and expires automatically?
Yeah, or something kind of that can be set in the tenant, like 60 days or 90 days.
Right. So the way to think about it, and we have not finalized this yet, but the way we are thinking about it is sophisticated management capabilities will be license-based, and basic capabilities would be just included as part of the product.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
In the old Azure Management Portal, you had to upload a CSV file,
yes.
And you couldn't invite consumer domains like Gmail, for example.
That's
and
all
now
going
you just
away.
Did that?
So the CSV, you didn't see the CSV anywhere.
Right.
We have actually removed it.
Okay.
The CSV was useful. We realized as we were doing the preview that CSV is useful for bulk invitations. And now the story is, for bulk invitations, you should use the API.
Mm-hmm.
We will support consumer domains because it's very important to do so.
Yeah.
And so that restriction has gone away. So that's a very important observation that you've made. It is actually by design that we have removed CSV.
Okay, so this is the way it will be, and this is the way it will be in the new portal.
That's right.
Okay, and in the old portal, you also had to be global admin to do all this?
Yes.
In the new portal, can you do it as user?
So as a member, you can invite. If you have access to the Azure portal, then you will be able to invite. A member can also invite. There's also, right now, I showed you the demo in the Azure portal.
Yeah.
But we are also introducing the same capabilities in the myapps.microsoft.com, which is actually the IW flow.
Mm-hmm.
And they will be able to leverage the same sort of mechanisms to invite users, add them to applications and groups. So both of them will be able to do it. And the API is, of course, if you write an application, it just depends on your app's authorization policy, who can access it. Mm-hmm. So the goal is both admins and end users and app developers, all of them should be able to use the invitation mechanism and invite people.
And what role do you have to have in the API to be able to trigger?
It depends on the policy. If you have set the policy that says members can invite, then you have to be a member. Mm-hmm. If you are, and we are also introducing a role called the guest inviter role, which I briefly mentioned in that UI.
Yeah, I saw that.
If you are belonging to that role, then you can invite. So that's the way you're thinking about it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. What if I invite an external user to something he doesn't have a license for? So let's say I want Project Online, and the user is not licensed for that in the source organization.
Yes. Then the licensing terms will govern that behavior. We are dissociating the user type from the ability to have licenses, but we want the product to be able to govern the capabilities that it gives out. And so there will be a licensing term that's governed entirely by the, for example, in this case, it will be governed by the project app.
Cool. Thanks.
Is B2B also possible for apps published through Azure Application Proxy?
So that's a great question. Well, honestly, we are still thinking about it. We do want, so there is a lot of interest in connecting these B2B scenarios to on-premises. There is a lot of interest, but the amount of interest that is in other features, like the group feature, the MFA feature, conditional access, is far greater. So we acknowledge that there's there, but we are going to go sequentially.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in the demo, you showed us about the partner, like the test.com. It created an account on the virtual tenant.
Yeah.
So in which case does it do it? Like whether the partner doesn't have an Active Directory or like, what is the?
Yeah, so the question is, when does the dynamic tenancy get created?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is when the user is not using a consumer domain, mm-hmm. he's using an organizational-like mm-hmm. domain, a closed domain, mm-hmm. and does not have a presence in AAD. When both of these things are true.
Azure AD.
In Azure AD.
Okay, but what if they have a federated AD?
That's fine. We'll still create, because the cloud tenancy is what we are creating. We are not doing anything else.
Mm-hmm.
We're just creating a representation mm-hmm. for that user and for that tenancy in the cloud. And you can eventually go and connect them to the on-premises as well, if you want to.
Okay.
Wrap up? Oh, yeah, sure. Oh, great. So let's take the question outside, because the next speaker is here.
Okay.
But I'll be outside. You can talk more.
Okay, thank you.